Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty coming up on this edition. Why are falling river levels causing problems for this country's economy?
Paraguay, as a landlocked country, and almost 80% of the total international commerce of Paraguay is going through the river by barge.
And fancy a walk into space, it could cost you up to $50 billion. But we are going to start the program in the world's largest economy, which of course is the US, and talk about one of its most famous companies, once again, Boeing. Because workers at its factories are voting as we speak to you about whether they should go on strike. To avert it this week, Boeing has been reaching out to its employees. We're going to hear from them in a few minutes' time. But let's bring in Scott Hamilton, aviation consultant at Liam Company, who's in Seattle. Scott, thanks for joining us once again on World Business Report. What exactly is happening in Seattle at the moment?
Well, right now, the voting by the biggest union that Boeing has, the International Association of Machinists, began at 5 a.m. Local time. It will end at 6 p.m. local time. We hope to have results by around 8 o'clock, and the expectation is that they will reject the contract and authorize a walkout at midnight.
What is it that they are most concerned about in the contract that Boeing has offered to them? What do they want to see changed?
Well, they want to see a higher wage increase than the 25% baseline that was offered. The union went into negotiations seeking a 40% increase. And I will add that that may seem big, which it is, but the wages have essentially been frozen for 16 years. And they think that the inflation has just overwhelmed any built-in wage increases during that time. They also want incentives and bonuses reinstated in the new contract that existed in the old contract. They wanted a defined pension benefit plan reinstated that was eliminated in the old contract. That one will never happen. And they wanted a guarantee that the next new Boeing airplane will be built here in Washington State. That's in the contract, but there's some criticism that it's only good for the life of the contract, which is a four-year contract.
Scott, let's have a listen to what Boeing has been saying to its employees this week.
Hi, I'm Jane with Boeing Communications. As you may know, Boeing and IAM 751 and W24 reached a tentative contract agreement earlier this week. Some of the highlights include a 25% general wage increase for all employees over the life of the contract. This includes an 11% pay increase on day one. A new Boeing contribution of up to $4,160 per year to an employee's individual IAM 401k account.
Scott, there's a lot that was on offer there. You've explained the wider context of this. Do you expect Boeing, if, as you say, it looks likely that the workers vote to go on strike, which will start very soon, won't it, to come back to the table and quickly meet the demands of the workers?
Well, they'll certainly come back to the table very quickly. I think that would happen within a week's time. How close or how much Boeing will sweeten the pot, of course, is anybody's guess. But given Boeing's precarious financial condition because of COVID, because of the MAX crisis that grounded the airplanes for 21 months in 2019, and a host of other issues, safety-related, Boeing does not have the financial strength that it had before to withstand a very long strike.
Stay there. I want to bring in Kerry Leahy, who's a regular guest on the program, economist at Columbia University. Kerry, Boeing, we've talked about it so much on this program. It seems to have been one problem after another for the company. Here's another possible problem on the horizon. And if production stops, even for a short period of time, that's going to affect his reputation again, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't make the case that the ripple effects will be terribly bad for the overall economy, though it may have an impact, obviously, in the Seattle region, but it would certainly be difficult. And as our previous speaker mentioned, they just don't have the financial wherewithal to last anything other than a fairly short strike. So they just do not have a long rope they can throw the union and say, we can wait you out. They don't really have that much time and money.
Scott, going back to you here, you're there in Seattle. Kelly Ortberg, the chief executive officer of Boeing, has walked into just even more problems here.
Yeah, he took office on August the 8th. Here we are on September the 12th, just 34 days later or thereabouts, with this contract vote. He walked into the office with contract negotiations already underway, Boeing under pressure. He's not had a lot of time to establish any kind of trust level at all with the employees. He made some good what I would call cosmetic moves, but they were sincere moves. But he's walked into an almost impossible situation.
And finally, Scott, on Boeing, the fact is they dominate the airline industry with Airbus. So clearly in the short term, a setback. In the long term, will it have much effect? Because even if production's delayed for a while, it's not as if people can go anywhere else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, Airbus just announced the deal for the A320 family that deliveries extend out to 2032. That's 8 years away. No, airlines and leasing companies don't really have much of an option. They have to stick with Boeing.
They certainly do. Scott, I'm sure you'll be watching that story over the next few hours. Still a long way to go before we get a result there in Seattle. Let's move to Europe now, because the European Central Bank has cut interest rates by a quarter percent point to 3.5% in response to falling Eurozone inflation and signs that the bloc's economy risks grinding to a halt. Let's get the thoughts of Carsten Breske, an economist at ING Research.
The market seemed to have understood what the ECB is looking at, and they saw inflation has continued to come down. The outlook for the European or the Eurozone economy has worsened, so it was time again to cut policy rates.
You said that the outlook has worsened. You were there in the industrial powerhouse of Europe, Germany. How dire is the situation?
We all know the headlines. People know the headlines. The sentiment is clearly dire. But when you look, it is not that an entire economy has come to a standstill. It is only that people are realizing that they are losing economic welfare. But this is not only about Germany. This is also about the entire Eurozone economy. I think for the last 2 years, they always predicted that the Eurozone economy would return to what we call potential growth rates in the next quarter. But they had to delay it every single quarter. And we now have an ECB expecting the Eurozone economy to return to its potential growth rate only in the second quarter of 2025. So even the ECB is now finally acknowledging that we're not only in some kind of short-term cyclical blip, we are in an environment of very weak economic growth.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the former Italian Prime Minister, Mario Draghi, he said that the EU really needs to look at a way to get more competitive because of the challenges it's facing from the likes of the US and China. How's it going to do that?
Well, that is a very good question. And Mario Draghi actually produced an excellent report. So how can we get out of this situation? We need to invest more. We need to spend more. Mario Draghi talks about an 800 billion euro investment package per year. This is between 4% and 5% of the European Union's GDP. But that's not everything. Mario Draghi calls for less bureaucracy, less regulation. Brussels should only mingle with stuff it really knows about. For the rest, keep its hands off. And Mario Draghi also calls for different competition policies because he says, you know, the Americans, they have their big tech giants. In Europe, we don't have tech giants because we work nationally. It's a very long list. But it also shows you there is no quick fix. It takes a long while before we get out of this current environment of subdued, stagnating growth.
When we talk about subdued, stagnating growth, how many more interest rate cuts do you think we're going to see? Because in a similar situation as the US, there are fears, aren't there, that some parts of the EU are toppling over?
I expect a lot. The problem.
Go on, give us a figure. What, when you say how low do you expect them to go?
I'll expect another 125 basis points rate cuts between now and the summer of 2025. The ECB, as all other major central banks, you know, have been fighting inflation, rightly so, because they missed inflation on its way up. So now we have actual inflation close to target. But, you know, it's too early for the ECB to officially say mission accomplished because they made the mistake in the past to underestimate inflation. But by being afraid, they're probably making the mistake to cut not aggressively enough right now in order to support economic growth.
Kerry, when Carsten talked there about not cutting aggressively enough, it did make me think of Jerome Powell, the man in charge of the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, because he's faced with a similar dilemma, isn't he?
Yes, it's not quite as extreme as discussed about the Eurozone, but they do have a possibility the economy could be much weaker than the Fed is forecasting. That's not my own forecast, but I certainly understand the point. But here in the States, the big change in the last week was that there was enough evidence from the inflation story of not so much it wasn't grinding lower, but some of the sectors were showing a bit of an upswing that makes probably an aggressive cut of 50 basis points unlikely. The Fed can move rapidly. I just don't think they need to because the economy still has a very low unemployment rate. Labor market is softening, but there's no reason for extreme gloom, and corporate earnings are also pretty good. So not everything is on the line of saying everything's weak and the Fed really ought to move more aggressively than they may do at the first try.
Interesting. So you think, because there's so much debate in the US and globally, because it is the most important economy in the world, about the state of it, some people fear that we're heading towards recession. From what you're saying, you don't agree with that view.
No, I mean, the point is the narrative of a softer economy is certainly there, but the narrative of the softer economy leading to a reduced pace of consumer spending, that's not happening. If anything, consumer spending pace is picking up. Now, you may say that could run out on a string rapidly, but you just don't have the traditional signals that you would see now of a really worsening default situation across the board and weaker corporate earnings that would be telling you a recession is looming. Just don't see that. You see, softening is here, but I don't think a recession is necessarily looming.
Okay, let's move to a country, the world's second biggest economy, which is having a few problems at the moment. China's stock markets have fallen to their lowest points in well over 5 years. Kerry, that economy, do you think it's facing a much more difficult situation with those housing problems than the fact is people are just not spending in China?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've said this for years now. We know the Chinese economy is going to blow up. We just don't know when. And the story they have now of dealing with the debt, hard to have consumers pick up the slack from the export and industrial sector. They're not in a very happy place, and they certainly have a much worse scenario than even the Europe has. So I'd be much more worried about China and affiliated Asian economies than any other region of the globe.
How much is that U.S. pressure and pressure to maybe a lesser extent from the EU for that China plus one policy affecting China? Is that part of the problem they're facing, a big part, or is it more domestic problems that they're facing?
It's both, but I'd say probably the domestic buildup of debt, particularly at the what we would say in the States, the non-federal level, is certainly indicative of a looming set of problems, even though it is a direct-controlled economy. But certainly the pushback from the U.S. and to a lesser extent Europe is certainly not helping them, because they just aren't going to be able to use exports as a growth engine. And their ability to dump products that the Japanese consumers don't want, like Teslas, they just aren't going to be able to dump that many Chinese Teslas on the United States anytime soon.
No. And of course, we are seeing, aren't we, many particular countries really being extremely worried about the possibility of dumping of cheap Chinese products across their borders. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution...
This is the most amazing time ever, and developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Service. Let us move to another part of the world now, and let's talk about Paraguay, because it's experiencing a historic downturn of the Paraguay River. Currently, the level in the port of Asunción is dangerously low. The Paraguay Paraná waterway is crucial to the Paraguayan economy, with 82% of international trade linked to this route. So what's the situation like for those who rely on the river for their businesses? Raul Valdez is the president of the Center of River and Maritime Shipowners in Paraguay.
We are reaching the lowest level ever on the Paraguay River. Now we're facing a severe drought during the whole year, actually. And by this time of the year, we're entering into the most critical part of the problem. The navigation is practically interrupted in the north of Asunción. And for the south of Asunción, where are located most of the ports for the exports and imports of Paraguay, we're still having reasonable draft level. However, we project that we have still 30 to 40 days of low water or descending levels. And we are expecting critical situation also for the next following week. So by now, the service is still running with low capacity. We estimate that maybe 50% of the total capacity of the fleet is already impacted. And we expect a heavy delays and cost increases in the overall transportation costs for our country.
That, of course, has a huge economic impact, doesn't it? And there are many agricultural products that go down the Paraguay River. The country's one of the largest exporters of soya beans. What economic impact is this having at the moment?
Of course, the Paraguay, as a landlocked country, already have a higher cost compared to our neighbors in terms of international commerce. And almost 80% of the total international commerce of Paraguay is going through the river by barge. So you can imagine how big the problem is for us when we have to deal with these low water levels. The costs are getting higher every day, not only for the agribusiness, it's also affecting for the transportations of fuels or fertilizers or other type of products that are critical for this region.
When you say costs are going up all the time, how much are they going up?
By now, we are estimating a total cost increase of 10 to 20%, but we are not reaching the bottom of the problem yet. At one time, it would be expected to increase at least 50%. For example, if the transit could not be completed all the way up to Asunción, there are ports in the southern part of Paraguay that we will need to make a transshipment and complete the route by truck. And in that case, the cost could reach at least 50% of the increasings.
Clearly, it's a very difficult situation. Are you finding that some boats are actually getting stuck as the water level goes down?
Yes. Actually, most of the barge lines by this time of the year, they already have moored vessels all over the Paraguay River because they cannot complete the traffic, specifically from Asunción to the north. As I mentioned before, 80% of the total international commerce depends on these waterways for Paraguay, but also the Paraguayan flag vessels provide services for all the region. Almost 90% of the total transportation services for all the waterways, including Brazilian, Bolivian, Uruguayan, and Argentinian products, are services provided by Paraguayan vessel flags.
Yeah, there's a lot of Brazilian iron ore that moves through Paraguay, isn't it? The drought seemed to be getting worse. That is nature. Yeah. What can be done to stop this situation happening? Because every year it gets worse and worse, doesn't it?
It is. We don't know if this will be the new pattern of the river cycles. Because in the last 4 years, three of them, we have a really drought season. We have a really low level. And it's not a coincidence that in two of these 4 years, we already reached the records or the lowest record ever as we are doing this time of year. So the recovery that we're expecting may be not or won't be that fast also. So in any way, we are assuming that we will reach to the summer of 2025 with really low levels also. We're expecting that the next year could be, we will be facing some similar situations. So we are not very positive in terms of the projections also.
Kerry, when we're listening to Raul Valdez there, it's just a reminder there that your country's economy or some countries' economies are just so dependent on natural factors. And if those factors change, there's very little they can do.
No, this is a very, yet again, another sobering story about the impact of global warming. And there isn't all that much you really can do. And you could argue that, you know, Paraguay is definitely a middle-income country, but it isn't a country that can probably devote enormous resources, particularly since they're stuck with one main waterway upon which most of the goods flow in and out of the country.
Yeah, difficult situation for them. We will keep across that story. Now, let's end with this one. Two non-professional astronauts have carried out the first ever spacewalk by civilians. The American billionaire Jared Isaacman, who funded the Polaris Dawn mission, and musician-turned-engineer Sarah Gillis, turned out of SpaceX's Dragon ship to test their next-generation spacesuits. Mr. Isaacman was followed by his fellow spacewalker, as we said there, Sarah Gillis.
Looks like a perfect world.
So, is this a sign of a new boom in the space business? A question for Carissa Christiansen, CEO of BryceTech Analytical and Engineering Consultancy firm based around the space economy.
The space economy, particularly the launch side, has been increasingly commercial, and that's been driven by billionaire investment over the last decade and beyond. So I think from an industry standpoint, this feels like another step in the progression.
And when you say progression, where is that road leading us to, do you think? What next?
If you want to make money selling human spaceflight, commercial human spaceflight, your number one customer is the U.S. government. Your next potential customers are other governments around the world. And then you can also sell seats to billionaires to go to low Earth orbit, which is a few hundred miles away from the Earth. That's an evolving business. It's a real business sector starting about 4 years ago. SpaceX conducted the first commercial human spaceflight on a company-owned vehicle for its customer, NASA. And NASA will continue to use commercial capability. Other nations will. There is a limited supply of billionaires. And so at a $50 million or so price per seat for, let's call it a standard mission to the International Space Station, most of what you're paying there is not paying NASA to use the space station. Most of what you're paying is for the launch cost. So beyond those businesses of supporting government missions and programs and some commercial activity in low Earth orbit, there's a very big leap to commercial businesses that might conduct planetary missions.
We like to focus, don't we, a lot on the private sector and billionaires going up into space. But it is that government sector that is the biggest sector. Is that continuing to grow a lot? Because we have so many countries looking at this area now, don't we?
It absolutely is growing. And I want to be clear, first of all, there are segments of the space economy that are very much not driven by government customers. When we think about telecommunications satellites, for example. But thinking about human spaceflight, that's still largely the province of governments. And there is growing interest in countries around the world in space activity. And one piece of that for some of those countries, whether that's for research purposes or prestige purposes or other policy goals, one piece of that can be human spaceflight.
Prestige. It is important, isn't it? It's important both in that private space sector, which is growing, as you said there, whether, you know, it's billionaires saying, I want to be the first one to do that spacewalk, or countries saying, I want to get into this industry because it shows where we're progressing technologically wise.
And it's interesting, too. It's absolutely an indication of a country's position on the geopolitical stage. It can also be a hook for science and technology and engineering and math education. It can also be a way for a country to build capabilities. People are interested in space. They're enthusiastic about space. And that has a lot of secondary and tertiary effects throughout a community.
We like to talk, don't we, a lot about people going up into space. But is it that other area that's really the more lucrative one when we're looking at the space economy, which is getting those satellites up into space?
Getting the satellites up into space is an okay business. Selling the services that satellites provide, that is where the massive space markets really live. That's where you can get to $100 billion markets when you look at television, direct-to-home television, and other kinds of satellites that carry television signals. When you look at mapping and positioning and navigation applications that actually use government-owned satellites, but are providing all sorts of commercial services that everybody uses every day on their cell phone.
Any chance we'll be seeing you up in space?
When the price drops just a smidge under $50 million, absolutely.
How much? 40? Is that going to be good enough for you?
We'll have to see how things go with this fiscal year.
We will go back to Carissa at the end of the fiscal year and see how the situation has been. Kerry, it's an incredible story, isn't it, that an American billionaire ends up funding a mission into space and trying out a new spacesuit.
Yeah, it's setting up a new target for keeping up with the Joneses, that every billionaire on the block now has to be able to have his own spacewalk. But it's also a very good point that the money isn't so much in putting things up in the air, but and all the electronics and the like that all spin off of that. So you make a lot of money if you're providing that kind of software and hardware, not necessarily in being the sexy guy putting the rocket in the air.
But just looking at some figures here from McKinsey, they're estimating that the global space industry, you know, would go up from $630 billion in 2023 to $1.8 trillion by 2035.
Yeah, that all makes sense because, there's a way to make money at it, and two, you have the additional point that was made earlier about the prestige and the spillovers from going into space, that it may actually help your overall economies do better and excite the populace. So it really does look like a growth industry for lots of different reasons.
Are we going to see you in space, Kerry? Probably not.
Probably not. I'm over 70, and I think it might be a little tough on my poor old heart.
I don't think so. Not at all. I know. We know how much you like to do your exercise, etc. Always a pleasure having you on the program. That is it, though, for this edition of World Business Report.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution,
this is the most amazing time ever, and developments in AI are super, super quickly changing,
to the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.